You know, when you search for something on Netflix, what you get is only a fraction of what they really have? The streaming service actually has more than 18,000 titles globally, but only about 6,000 of those are available in the good old US of A. That means you're missing out on literally thousands of great shows. Unless, of course, you use ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is an app that lets you change your online location, protecting your devices from unwanted snooping and allowing you to control where streaming services and other websites think you're located. There are over 100 different locations to choose from, which means you have access to thousands of new shows and movies no matter where you live. This doesn't just work with Netflix, it works with Disney Plus, Hulu, Max, a UK streamer called BBC iPlayer, and more. I was on a work trip in the UK during the final season of Game of Thrones, and I tried logging into my HBO account to watch a new episode, but the technology wouldn't let me because of geo-blocking. And I wish I had this app at that moment, because I now realize how incredibly easy it is to work around that problem. Here's a more recent example. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is not streaming on Netflix in the US, but I just fired up the episode where Dennis tries to have a peaceful mental health day, and technology keeps interrupting his plans. All I had to do was open ExpressVPN, connect to a UK server, refresh Netflix, and the show just popped up. It's super easy. I've also heard good things about that show called Billions, but I've never been a Showtime subscriber, so I've never seen it. But it's actually available right now on Netflix in South Korea, and with ExpressVPN, it took 5 seconds to switch over and start checking it out. With ExpressVPN, you get high-quality streaming from devices like your phone, laptop, tablet, and TV, and crucially, it protects your privacy and security to keep your information safe from hackers. Stop missing out on great TV and get thousands of new shows with ExpressVPN. We got them to give you all 3 extra months free when you use our special link, expressvpn.com/film. That's expressvpn.com/film to get 3 extra months completely free.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for July 25th, 2018. On today's episode, we'll discuss the latest TV and film news. This is Slash Film Editor-in-Chief Peter Serretta, and joining me on today's podcast is Slash Film Senior Writer Ben Pearson.
Hey, what's going on?
And writer Chris Evangelista.
Hello.
Okay, guys, I think this is the first time in over a week that we have a normal news-filled episode of Slash Film Daily. So I guess let's just jump into it. Let's start off with Mission Impossible Fallout. It turns out this is the most expensive edition of the Mission Impossible franchise. Ben, you wrote this up for the site. What do we know?
Yeah, so when Tom Cruise broke his ankle filming a stunt for Mission Impossible Fallout, which is the new movie that comes out this weekend, the production had to shut down for several weeks, and that hiatus ended up making this movie the most expensive Mission Impossible movie yet. Apparently, the film's budget is now around $250 million, largely because of that hiatus break that they had to take there, and according to The Hollywood Reporter, the reason for the addition is that the biggest added cost for Fallout was paying the cast and crew for the 8-week hiatus so they wouldn't take another job. So it's not like they did costly reshoots or anything, which is often what we hear about, when movies take big hiatuses like this. So that didn't happen. But yeah, just the idea that their key star during an injury that happened on the set, having to necessitate the shutdown, means that the budget boosted pretty high. So I guess insurance is going to be covering a good percentage of this, because like I said, this happened on set. It was during the production. So but even, offsetting the insurance's, contributions to how this whole thing is going to shake out, the total is going to be closer to somewhere like $180 million, and even that is still more expensive than Rogue Nation and all of the other movies in the Mission Impossible franchise.
Yeah, to give you an idea, $250 million is a lot. Avatar, which was made in 2009 at this point, was made for $237 million, so less money than Mission Impossible Fallout. But yeah, taking out all that, what did you say it went down to? 180?
Yeah, approximately 180 is the reported budget according to a source who spoke with Hollywood Reporter.
So that's like on par with like Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. So that's still a lot of money. But let's move on. Speaking of Marvel movies, let's move on to Ant-Man and the Wasp. It turns out that film was originally going to have a Captain America cameo. Chris, tell us about it.
So according to director Peyton Reed, there was originally a plan for Luis, the character played by Michael Peña, to retell, you know, the events of the famous tarmac fight in Captain America's Civil War. And during, you know, that whole, you know, if you've seen the Ant-Man movies, you know these scenes play out where Michael Peña is talking very fast, and we get to see recreations of things that already happened with his voice coming out of other actors' mouths, and it's very funny. And according to Peyton Reed, they were going to have one of these moments with Chris Evans' Captain America. But in the end, they decided to cut it because they wanted Ant-Man and the Wasp to be its own standalone thing, which I know it makes sense, but I really wish this had happened because I'm sure it would have been very funny.
Yeah, I need more stories from Luis in this movie. It is interesting that first Ant-Man movie, Edgar Wright split from Marvel because of, creative differences, and a lot of those creative differences had to do with Marvel wanting to tie it in to the MCU further by having like cameos and character appearances, and it just seems like this time around it was all about making it standalone. But yeah. Anyways, let's move on to our next topic, which is a research team has claimed to have discovered the formula for box office success. So apparently, there's an algorithm out there that can guarantee studios make their money back. Ben, we should be investing in this, right?
I mean, I feel like if it was that simple, Hollywood would have already figured this out. But some researchers at the University of Birmingham in the UK, a professor of behavioral economics and data science specifically, led this effort to categorize over 6,000 movie scripts using algorithms into six defined types of emotional stories. And you can read, I broke it down on this in this article that you can find at slashfilm.com, so I'm not going to go through all of it, but basically what they came up with was this man in the hole emotional story, this categorization, which is
Give
defined by,
us, yeah, give us some examples of this. What is the man
So
in the hole?
it's basically the fall followed by a rise. So the fall of a character followed by I guess, overcoming of an obstacle from that character, of that character. They said that The Godfather is like the preeminent example of this. So man in a hole stories, according to their calculations and algorithms and all that, are, while they're not the most liked of these different types, they are the most talked about, and they also tend to perform better at the box office than movies in any other category on average. So the average cost of one of these types of movies, according to again, this is only like a 6,000 film script subject
Analysis.
group,
Yeah.
analysis, exactly. So it's not like a definitive thing, but anyway,
And to give you an idea, they make 600 movies a year. So
right,
that's
yeah.
only about a 10-year sampling.
Right. So according to their research, the man in the hole stories are the average cost of them is about $40 million to make, but they earn about $54 million on average. So, I mean, to me, like for a few things immediately jumped out at me when I was reading about this. So, first of all, movies that cost around $40 million to make, as has been exhaustively detailed over the past 10 or 15 years, are increasingly rare in Hollywood because the industry has basically turned to making micro-budget movies or huge budget blockbusters for its business model, basically. And then,
But
yes, of
Ben,
course,
if they were following this system, Hollywood could be printing money. They should be making these mid-budget $40 million man in a hole films. Like all next year is just going to be man in a hole. Like that's going to be the title of the big film of the year, man in a hole.
I mean, I would not be surprised if some studio head saw this and was like, let's do it. Let's give it a shot. But I mean, that's the thing, though. The man in the hole categorization, the description of that category, the fall followed by a rise, that's basically the template for storytelling in the Western world. Like, a protagonist is wandering around, going about their business. They encounter a challenge, and then they overcome that challenge. When you boil it down so hard to its you know, prime degrees like that, these elements, you lose any nuance. It's like you can narrow that down. You can narrow any movie down to...
Wait, I need to hear. What are some of the other, like, you know, movie categories that make money?
Yeah. So they say that rags to riches is one, like the ongoing emotional rise as seen in The Shawshank Redemption. There's one that's the inverse of that, which is riches to rags, which is the ongoing emotional fall, like you see in Psycho. Another one is The Cinderella, which is a rise followed by a fall, followed by a rise, as seen in the movie Babe. So, I mean, there are a couple other ones here. But really, I mean, the idea of, like, data analyzation to figure out this mystical formula that unlocks the key to Hollywood success is not a new idea. Ryan Kavanaugh, who's the former head of Relativity Media, tried to build an entire studio on the idea of using these, you know, of crunching the numbers to basically predict what kinds of movies audiences are going to like. And yeah, he had a few hits here and there, but Relativity ended up going bankrupt twice. So it's not, it might be tempting to look at this as like a get rich quick kind of scheme of like, oh, all we have to do is do this. But, you know, there's so much more that goes into making of a movie than just these boilerplate templates like this.
This makes me want to look at, like, the list of the, you know, worst grossing film, or, you know, the most disappointing at the box office films of all time, and see how many actually fit into this category. Like, right. John Carter, a famous Disney bomb. Wouldn't that fit The Man in the Hole, I guess, maybe?
I think, yeah, probably.
But I guess it was made for $264 million instead of $40. That was Disney's mistake, obviously.
Yes, of course.
Okay, anyways, let's move on to the Coen brothers, who have apparently re-edited a TV series into a movie. Chris, tell us about that.
Yeah, the Coen brothers, last year it was announced they were doing a Netflix TV series called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is my favorite name to say now. And it was originally going to be a 6-episode anthology for Netflix. Now, it's still coming to Netflix, but instead of being 6 parts, the Coen brothers have decided to just re-edit it into a film. And this will also be just in time for the Venice Film Festival, where it's going to premiere. So rather than get this in TV format, we're getting it in a film format. And I'm a little conflicted here because, you know, on one level, I'm very excited for a new Coen Brothers movie. But on another level, I was kind of looking forward to the idea of a Coen Brothers TV series. And I'm hoping one day maybe they'll put out like a Blu-ray or something with all the footage they ended up cutting out to get this down into a film.
Now, do we know, has this ever happened before?
What, a TV show edited into a movie?
Yeah.
David Lynch technically did that with Mulholland Drive. That was originally a pilot, and he went back and added on it and turned it into a film. So there is that. But I don't know if there's ever been a case where a whole series, a whole season has been edited down into a film.
Yeah, it's interesting because I forget what show it was on Netflix, but last year I watched a show, I think it was like a BBC series, and it was like 6 episodes long, and it was a comedy, so it was like 23 minutes an episode, and I binge watched it. I don't even remember what it was, but it ended up being like, you know, 2 hours and 20 minutes, and I was like, it's funny that Netflix didn't just like package this together, because it was like one whole story and could have turned it into a movie. But I got, you know, obviously it was directed by different directors. You can't do that. I don't know. I'm wondering if, why did this happen? Like, why did they decide to release it as a movie instead of a TV series?
They really didn't give any specific reason. I mean, maybe it just wasn't working as a TV series. You know, I guess one of the good things about Netflix is people who work for them, the creators who work for them, have a lot of freedom. So maybe while shooting and while editing the series, the Coen brothers realized this isn't working and let's make it a movie. They did something similar to this before in the past where they went back and released a director's cut of their first film, Blood Simple. And unlike other director's cuts, which tend to be longer than the theatrical cut, the Blood Simple director's cut was actually shorter in that they trimmed a few minutes off it and made it an overall tighter film. So maybe that was the case here. Maybe they just didn't like where the TV version was going and decided instead to turn it into a film.
Have you ever seen that director's cut with the audio commentary, Chris?
The Blood Simple one?
Yeah.
Yes, I have.
It's great. I believe it's the Coen brothers pretending to be Hollywood executives or something.
Yeah, there's like a it's they love to just basically mess around with for years they would take credit as like editors for they would use like a fictional name as an editor for their films, but it was just them editing it.
Yeah, no, if you have that Blood Simple DVD or Blu-ray, I'd go check that out if you haven't, because I feel like it's one of those special features that many people might overlook because, you know, it's not on the packaging, the filmmaker giving the audio commentary, but it is great. It is a piece of art from the Coen brothers themselves. But let's move on to some spinoff news. The Men in Black spinoff is gearing up, and we have learned that Emma Thompson is joining the cast, reprising her role from part 3. Ben, tell us about it.
Yeah, that's basically all we know from this one is that Emma Thompson, who played Agent Zero in 2012's Men in Black 3, is going to be coming back to reprise that role. So we know that Agent Zero is sort of like the leader of the Men in Black. She took over that role after Rip Torn, who played Zed in the first two movies. I guess he died in the third entry. It's been so long since I've seen Men in Black 3. I think I saw it once in the theaters and basically just completely forgot about the movie. I know it involved time travel. There's a lot of weird stuff going on in that film. But Emma Thompson is great. I mean, any movie that adds her, I mean, like, she automatically makes everything better. She's an Oscar-winning actress, an Oscar-winning screenwriter. This is, I think, the second time that she will be returning to play the same character in a popular film franchise, because she was also in the Harry Potter movies. So we know that she's the leader of the Men in Black, and also Liam Neeson has been added to the cast of this spinoff. We knew about that, but he is going to be playing the leader of the London branch of the Men in Black, and this spinoff or reboot or whatever it's ultimately going to be is supposed to take the action to a more global scale. So maybe the two of them are going to, I don't know, they could have a big business meeting about how they're going to run the Men in Black on a global scale. I don't know exactly if they're going to interact in person or share the screen, but if they do, it'll make a nice little reunion for them, because they were both in Love Actually back in 2003.
Now, did we always know that this was going to be set in the same universe? I mean, it is a spinoff, but it's kind of a bit of a reboot as well. Did we know that there was going to be connections?
I think they have not said whether or not Will Smith or Tommy Lee Jones, the stars of the first three movies, are going to be coming back, but I would not rule out a quick cameo from them. I think because I haven't said it on this episode, Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson are leading the cast in this new edition. I think this is the first official connection we have between this new movie and the original trilogy. So I don't know. I mean, that certainly opens the door for the possibility of a cameo for Will Smith or Tommy Lee Jones. Now that we know it's 100% set in that same universe.
I'm going to predict right now that Will Smith appears either in one of the final two scenes of the movie or in an after credit or in credits scene. That's my prediction.
Mark it down. Anything.
Yeah. Let's move on to Hamilton, which might be headed to the big screen sooner than we think, but not as we had hoped. Chris, tell us about it.
Everyone knows Hamilton. It's a huge hit. It's a Pulitzer Prize winning musical. Everyone knows what it is, even if you don't follow Broadway news. And as is the case with most big musicals, it's only a matter of time before Hollywood comes calling and turns this into a big movie. And we had assumed it would take a while for this, just because the film, the play is still running and they don't want to, you know, have the movie competing with the play. They want to get as many people at the play as possible. But now comes word there is going to be a film sooner than we thought, but it's not going to be the big Hollywood, you know, remake of the play. Instead, right before Lin-Manuel Miranda, the creator and original star of Hamilton, left, you know, the original cast, along with pretty much all the original cast started to leave in 2016. They recorded a live performance with the entire original Broadway cast doing the play from beginning to end. And at the time that was recorded, no one knew when or where that was going to pop up. We just knew it was being recorded for posterity. But now word has it that pretty much every studio in Hollywood is in a bidding war trying to get the rights to this, with the intention to release it in either 2020 or 2021 in theaters.
And it'll only cost you $200 a ticket for front row. Or you can enter that lottery to go to your local AMC and see it for free. I'm kidding. Yeah. I'm joking.
Yes. And the story came from the Wall Street Journal, and the word is that the rights to this could sell for up to $50 million, which is a lot of money for which is essentially a recorded play. Like, that's a huge amount of money, but obviously everyone wants a piece of Hamilton.
That's insane. But, you know, I know Hamilton is touring right now, but a lot of people have not gotten the chance to see it unless they traveled, you know, to New York, LA, you know, any of the big cities that have gotten it. And even then, you know, tickets were not the easiest or cheapest to come by. So, you know, I know this is good because it will bring this play to the masses. But I think what I'm waiting for is the big screen adaptation of Hamilton. Do you think releasing the play in theaters, and especially on this scale of, you know, they're hoping to at least, if they're selling it for $50 million, they're hoping to at least make, what, $150 million at the box office with this? Or it's you break even because, you know, theaters take, you know, upwards of 50%. Do you think releasing the play in theaters will prevent us from ever getting an actual narrative adaptation of Hamilton in theaters?
No, I think it's pretty much a given that that's going to happen. You know, one of the stipulations in this sale is that whoever buys it, they can't release it until 2020 or 2021. And that's very specific because, you know, they want the play to, you know, have, you know, I guess, a last hurrah before they unveil it to everyone. But the Hamilton is a money-making machine, and I don't think that's going to stop anytime soon.
But you think if tons of people go to see this, if this makes $300 million at the domestic box office, do you think studios are still going to be jumping to make that, you know, non-stage version of that for the silver screen?
I do, because I also think there's going to be like a weird stigma with this where people are going to be like, ugh, I don't want to go see a filmed play. I want to see a movie. So I feel like there is going to be an audience out there who would rather see the Hollywood version. I mean, we might not get it for many years. Like, you know, the Hollywood version of Les Miserables took a long time. We're just getting the Cats movie now, and that debuted on Broadway many years ago. So
in the like 80s, I think.
Yeah, so we might not get it for another 10 years, but it's gonna happen.
And like Wicked, I think, has been in development, a Wicked movie, for a long, long time, and that one still hasn't come to the big screen yet.
Yeah, and this isn't the first time that this has happened. Obviously, Fathom events have often brought you know, stage musicals to the big screen for one night events that are priced at a higher price, ticket price. But it sounds like this would be a wide release, you know, bringing Hamilton to the masses. Let's move on, though, to Enter the Dragon. Turns out they're trying to remake this one as well with Deadpool 2 director David Leitch. Ben, tell us about it.
Yeah, so directors like Spike Lee and Brett Ratner over the years have tried to remake Enter the Dragon, but it seems like David Leitch, who just directed Deadpool 2 and Atomic Blonde, is the latest director to potentially give it a shot. So I think from this report from deadline. They don't have a writer attached to this yet, but Leach, who also directed or co-directed the first John Wick movie, and he was a stunt guy. He's also directing Hobbs and Shaw, which is the first Fast and Furious spinoff movie. He is now attached to direct this film. So, I mean, he's obviously a guy who knows a lot about fight sequences and stunt choreography and stuff like that. So he makes a certain amount of sense for an Enter the Dragon remake. I know that a lot of people probably think that the idea of remaking Enter the Dragon, which is like a 1973 Bruce Lee martial arts movie, might seem like a sacrilegious idea, but I haven't seen the movie in a long, long time. But from what I remember of it, it's basically just like a martial arts competition movie. And we've seen so many of those over the years that it almost feels like this movie has been remade anyway. Chris, I think when this came up, you said something about how Bruce Lee was the reason that this movie succeeds, right?
Yeah, it's a weird idea to me. I mean, like you said, this idea has essentially been remade before. I mean, the Mortal Kombat movie is pretty right. much a remake of this idea, but it just feels wrong to call it Enter the Dragon. Like, I get why they would do that because it has, you know, brand recognition, and that's all anyone cares about. But it just feels wrong because it just feels like that belongs so entirely to Bruce Lee and his legacy. Like, I'm all for a martial arts movie directed by David Leitch because that guy is great at directing action, but just, you know, just call it something else. You can still have dragon in the title. Just call it something else.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I was doing some research for this article, I saw that Kurt Sutter, who is the creator of the FX show Sons of Anarchy, was actually looking to make an Enter the Dragon remake his directorial debut back in 2009. So this is like almost 10 years ago. And that version of the movie would have been called Awaken the Dragon. And it would have starred Rain, the Korean pop star who was in movies like Ninja Assassin. He was like a big deal for 1 second in the late 2000s. But yeah, we don't know anything about a title for this one or a plot or how, you know, if it's going to be more of a sequel or a remake, a traditional remake or, you know, set in the same universe or any of that stuff. So yeah, maybe he'll take that, a page from Kurt Sutter's playbook and call it Awaken the Dragon.
See, I'm not a huge Bruce Lee fan. I just never got into the martial arts world. By the way, it was weird seeing on the Comic-Con show floor, one of the big like exclusives that everybody was reselling was like a gold Bruce Lee Funko Pop, that everybody was trying to flip. But I don't know. So to me, I don't believe it's like sacrilegious to remake Enter the Dragon. Just to me, it just seems like, what's the point if you don't have Bruce Lee? Like that is the whole thing about that movie is Bruce Lee. And if you don't have a martial arts star of his caliber, what is the point?
Right. Yeah. I mean, maybe it's going to be a launch pad for a new sort of up and coming person. Leach, like I said, he used to be a stuntman, so he probably knows a lot of people in that world who haven't gotten the shot at stardom that maybe he might be able to provide for them. So I don't know. That's a very valid question, Peter. We'll have to see what they do with casting for this one.
Okay, let's move on to our last and final story. This is something that hit last week while we were at Comic-Con and Ben was covering while we were all in San Diego, and that is that they are rebooting Buffy the Vampire Slayer with a black lead and with Joss Whedon involved. Ben, tell us about it.
Yeah, so Monica Usuwu-Breen, if that's not how you pronounce your name, Monica, I apologize. She's the creator of a show called Midnight Texas, is going to serve as a writer, executive producer, and the showrunner of a Buffy the Vampire Slayer reboot TV series. So Joss Whedon is also on board as an executive producer. Whedon, who you know created the Buffy movie and the long-running original TV show that was on, I think it was on the WB and UPN back in the day. This show ran from 1997 to 2003, and it starts Sarah Michelle Gellar. We don't really know much about the show other than that the new version will feature a black female lead. It's in development right now, and the show is going to be pitched around to a bunch of different networks this summer. There's no official script yet, but the reboot is said to be contemporary, building on the mythology of the original. So again, there's potentially the door is open for cameos and things like that from previous cast members. Joss Whedon just recently signed a deal to write, direct, and be the showrunner of a new HBO show called The Nevers. According to Deadline, he will definitely be creatively involved with this Buffy reboot, and he's already working with Monica Osuwu-Breen on bringing it to life right now.
Now, were either of you big fans of the Buffy the Vampire series?
I was a huge fan, and I still am.
So how do you feel about this, Chris, being a huge fan?
You know, it's weird. When it was announced, I was like, well, that's surprising, but I don't have any problem with the idea. And then Candace Frederick wrote an article for us about how the title of the article is "Talent of Color Do Not Need a White TV Show and Film Hand-Me-Downs." And I hadn't even considered that, but that's a pretty interesting point that, you know, why just reboot this? Why not create something new for a Black female lead? But I don't know. It's weird because, you know, I'm a big Buffy fan, and I know Joss Whedon has sort of fallen out of favor due to some really terrible personal decisions he's made. But, you know, I think that show holds up. I don't really know how to feel about this. Like I said, I have no problem with the idea. I'm not like, oh my God, how dare you reboot this? But it does seem a little strange.
You know, I do love that Hollywood is getting more diverse and realizing that people want to see more diverse casts on the big screen. It does seem to me like, you know, after Twilight became huge, you know, the whole, you know, strong, you know, quote unquote strong female lead, you know, in these like teen adaptations, like Hollywood, like, you know, sucked onto that concept. And you know, it's obviously, you know, Wonder Woman is helping facilitate, you know, Hollywood to greenlight more movies that have female lead characters and even like superhero roles. And now with like the success of Black Panther, I feel like everyone's like, oh, there's another market that we have not been, you know, catering to. People actually want to see that kind of person in the forefront of this kind of show. I just wish it wasn't so icky the way that they just realized, like, oh, there's a marketplace there. Like, it should just be more organic. I'm not saying that there shouldn't be a reboot of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but, like, I think I'm basically agreeing with what Candace and Chris said, that, you know, why not come up with a – why not find, you know, a Black female actress that you believe in and – create a show around them, an original show. I mean, I do on one hand appreciate that Hollywood is going in this direction, but I just wish it wasn't. It feels like they're only doing it because they're jumping on the trend train of, and they see money at the end of
it's
the,
like,
the tracks.
Like diversity for the sake of showiness is basically what you're saying. Like they're just doing it because they don't look
good. Oh no, I don't think it's showiness. I think that they see that there's a lot of money in it, and like think like they're like, oh, you know, let's just. And there was a trend for a while there of let's remake movies and, you know, gender swap, and that's still happening. And you know, it's been successful, and it's been, you know, they've had failures like Ghostbusters. I just feel like when you approach things in that way, you're approaching it. Hey, when you approach any story or movie in the way of like, let's do this for the money and not because this is a cool story, concept, idea, I feel like you're approaching it in the wrong way. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be. They definitely should. There should be more diverse stars on our TVs and our big screens. I just wish, you know, I wish Ocean's 8, which I thought was an okay movie, didn't have to be an Ocean's movie. Do you know what I mean? Like it felt kind of calculated in a way that I didn't like, and maybe more people didn't show up because like it just feels like a studio's trying to be like, oh, there's a female audience out there, we'll take advantage of them.
Yeah, I think the answer to that is probably just for people to get out and actually support the things that that represent what they want to see, you know, like like stop going to see Transformers 7 and instead go see, you know, a mid-budget movie that stars a bunch of women or something, you know, if you want to see more movies that star women, you know what I mean? Like that kind of, I think money talks is basically what it boils down to.
I don't know what my frustration is, because obviously this is a business and obviously these studios are in it to make money and not art. But I just wish that it started with the art, and then, you know, good art gets the, you know, makes money most, I think, a lot of the time. I don't know. Maybe that's too optimistic.
But, well, I think we just have to put our hopes in the people who are actually in the trenches making this stuff, and hoping that they can smuggle some of the art into the commerce, right? Like, that's the big hope, I think, is things, even if they look like cash grabs, maybe they'll always turn out better than we think, because they may not have been greenlit based on the great creative original idea, but maybe those things can be applied to the template afterwards.
Yeah. One last question for you, Chris. Since you were a fan of the original Buffy, and Joss Whedon is going to be involved in this, are you more excited because he's involved, or would you be more excited to have, you know, some hip upcoming showrunner involved in this?
That's conflicting too, because like I said, you know, I know Joss Whedon is pretty much canceled now, as the kids say, based on, you know, his personal stuff. But, you know, I do think he's a good writer. I do think his work on Buffy is great, but I also feel like if this is a Buffy for a new generation, he probably shouldn't be involved. It should be someone, you know, completely new, someone taking it in a new direction, because I don't know. I feel like the way to approach this is not so much as a reboot, just have this new character just be another Slayer. Like, don't call it Buffy the Vampire Slayer, because on the show Buffy, like the final season, they introduced basically like hundreds and hundreds of Slayers. So, you know, why not make this like a spinoff instead of just calling it Buffy? But I don't know.
I'm guessing that's what they're going to do, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't know how you would involve cameos from, you know, the Buffy mainstays if this was, if you're rebooting Buffy in that way. But we'll have to see. We'll keep an eye on out on this. I will link to Candace's piece in the show notes, and all the stories we talked about today will be linked in the show notes. Chris, where can people find more of your work online?
I'm at slashfilm.com, and I'm on Twitter at cevangelista413.
Ben, where can we find you?
I am also at slashfilm.com. You can find me on Twitter at Ben Pears.
You can find me on all social media at slashfilm. This podcast, Slash Film Daily, is published every weekday on iTunes, Google Play, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps. Please feel free to send us your feedback, questions, comments, concerns to peter@slashfilm.com. And please go rate and review this podcast on iTunes. Tell your friends, spread the word, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Transform your home in one weekend and get big savings on everything for your project at Menards. Menards carries the largest selection of Purdy painting tools you need to get your painting project started. From brushes, paint, roller covers, and even paint kits. Hurry in and save big money on Purdy painting supplies. Get everything you need for your painting project at Menards. Plus, check out Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.